This text, written in collaboration with Kells Elvins in 1938, commemorates the first appearance of Dr. Benway. It's called Twilight's Last Gleamings. It. SS America off Jersey Coast. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no cause for alarm. We have a minor problem in the boiler room, but everything is now under sound effects of a nuclear blast. Explosion splits the boat. Dr. Benway's ship's doctor drunkenly added 2 inches to a 4-inch incision with one stroke of his scalpel. Perhaps the appendix is already out, doctor, the nurse said, peering dubiously over his shoulder. I saw a little scar. The appendix already out. I'm taking the appendix out. What do you think I'm doing here? Perhaps the appendix is on the left side, doctor. That happens sometimes, you know. Stop breathing down my neck. I'm coming to that. Don't you think I know where an appendix is? I studied appendectomy in 1904 at Harvard. He lifts the abdominal wall and searches along the incision, dropping ashes from his cigarette. Get me a new scalpel. This one's got no edge to it. He thrusts a red fist at her. The doctor reels back and flattens against the wall, a bloody scalpel clutched in one hand. The patient slides off the operating table, spilling intestines across the floor. Dr. Benway sweeps instruments, cocaine, and morphine into his satchel. Sour up. I can't be expected to work under such conditions. By the dawn's early light, Dr. Benway pushed through a crowd at the rail and boarded the first lifeboat. Are you all right, he said, seating himself among the women. I'm the doctor. Thank you. This is from a Western in Progress entitled The Place of Dead Roads. And my protagonist, Kim Carson, finds himself in deadly conflict with Mr. Hart, the press tycoon, and old man Bickford, a beef and oil baron. And Bickford has a special price on Kim's head because Kim killed old man Bickford's son in a gunfight. Real Western. Yeah. For 3 days, Kim camped on the mesa top, sweeping the valley with his binoculars. A cloud of dust headed south told him they figured him to ride south for Mexico. He had headed north instead into a land of sandstone formations, and everywhere caves popped into the red rock like bubbles in boiling oatmeal. Some of the caves had been lived in at one time or another. Rusty tin cans, pottery shards, cartridge cases. Kim found an arrowhead 6 inches long, chipped from obsidian, and a smaller arrowhead of rose-colored flint. Dusk was falling and blue shadows gathered in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains to the east. Sangre de Cristo, blood of Christ, rivers of blood, mountains of blood. Does Christ never get tired of bleeding? It is raining in the Jimenez Mountains. It is raining, Anita Huffington. Last words of General Grant spoken to his nurse. Circuits in his brain flickering out like lightning in gray clouds. Pottery shards, arrowheads, rusting fish hooks. You can see there was a cabin here once. A hypodermic syringe glints in the sun. He holds the rose flint arrowhead in his hand. And he fondles the obsidian arrowhead, so fragile, do they break every time they were used like bee stings, he wonders. Somebody made this arrowhead. It had a creator long ago. This arrowhead is the only proof of his existence. So living things can also be seen as artifacts designed for a purpose. So perhaps the human artifact had a creator. Perhaps a stranded space traveler needed the human vessel to continue his voyage, and he made it for that purpose. He died before he could use it. He found another escape route. This artifact, shaped to fill a forgotten need, now has no more meaning or purpose than this arrowhead without the arrow and the bow, the arm and the eye. Or perhaps the human artifact was the creator's last card played in an old game many light years ago. Chill of empty space, Kim gathers wood for a fire. The stars are coming out. There's the Big Dipper. His father points to Betelgeuse in the night sky over St. Louis. His father's gray face on a pillow. Helpless pieces in the game he plays on this checkerboard of nights and days. So fragile, shivers and gathers wood. Slave gods in the firmament. He remembers his father's last words. Stay out of churches, son. All they got a key to is the shit house. And swear to me, you will never wear a policeman's badge. Hither and thither moves and checks and slays, and one by one back in the closet lays rusty tin cans, pottery shards, cartridge cases, arrowheads, a hypodermic syringe glints in the sun. This folkloric text from the Lexington Narcotic Hospital was actually inspired by Juvenal, the Roman satirist. He's speaking of Greek parasites and sycophants. All arts, all sciences, a fasting Greek knows, bid him go to hell he goes. If you but say you're warm, he breaks into a sweat. If you complain of a draft, he calls for his overcoat. There is an exclusive wing of Lexington reserved for the do-rights, who are considered good rehabilitation prospects. They get better rooms and more medications. A do-right always shows up with letters from his clergyman, banker, employer, and, you know, pictures of himself as an Eagle Scout, shaking hands with a priest on graduation day. There's no limit to what they'll do. You know, that type falls all over himself to light the boss's cigarette. The doctor walks into the ward and says, rather warm in here. As one man, the do-rights break out in a sweat and rush around opening windows. Cold in here, isn't it? Immediately, the do-rights see their breath in the air, snatch blankets, and bundle themselves up to a chorus of chattering teeth. Front office brown nose sphinct to the bone. Doctor, when I die, I want to be buried right in the same coffin with you. You're the finest, most decent, most deeply humane man I've ever known. I'm putting you down for additional medication, son. Thank you, Doctor. Pusher should receive the death penalty. Of such stuff are due rights made. Get there firstest with the brownest nose. While down in the dim gray wards and day rooms where the due wrongs hawk and spit and shiver and vomit, fucking Crooker wouldn't give me a goofball. He asked me what the American flag means to me, and I tell him, soak it in the heroin, Doc, and I'll suck it. He says I got the wrong attitude. I should see the chap and get straight with Jesus. And then, with the tears streaming down their lousy fink faces, the two rights leap up as one man and bellow out the Star-Spangled Banner. This is a place of dead roads. Rod riding yeggs and peat men and cat burglars, bindle stiffs and hobo jungles. Here is Salt Chunk Mary the Fence in her red brick house down by the tracks in Portobello, Idaho. Mary keeps an iron pot of pork and beans always on the fire. You eat first and talk business later. Watches and rings slop down on the kitchen table. She names a price. She doesn't name another. Mary could say no quicker than any woman I ever knew, and none of her no's ever meant yes. She kept the money in a cookie jar, but nobody thought about that. Her cold gray eyes would have seen the thought, and maybe something goes wrong on the next lay. John Law just happens by, or a citizen comes up with a load of double zero buckshot into your soft and tenders. Got it. Like Mr. Hart, Kim has a dark side to his character. Unlike Mr. Hart, Kim is not afraid to hear the word death or take his bloody chances in a shootout. Saturday night, and maybe somebody from across the river comes into Uncle Tessa's saloon looking for trouble. He won't have to look far. The short barrel double action 44 tonight, Kim decides. As soon as Kim walks through the swinging door, he knows this is it. Two men at the bar by the door. One is tall and thin with a dead, sour, wooden face. The other tall and fattish and loose-lipped with lead-gray eyes. Loose-lipped smile showing his awful yellow teeth. Now, I don't like drinking in the same room with a fairy. Do you, Clem? Kent says I do, Cash. Yeah, they want to bat it around a while, but Kim doesn't. Are you gentlemen referring to me? Kim's hand sweeps down to his belt and up smooth and casual, like he was giving Clem his visiting card. As Clem clears his holster with the 45, Kim shoots him in the stomach. Clem doubles forward and his false teeth fly out. His 45 plows a hole in the floor. Kim pivots and shoots Cash in the hollow of the throat. The bullet goes through and spatters the wall with slivers of white bone. Cash buckles and his 45 chunks back into the holster. Klamath weaving around trying to recock his 45 with numb fingers. Taking his time, Kim shoots him in the forehead. Both assholes are dead before they hit the floor. As Kim looks down at the two bodies crumpled there, spilling blood and brains on the floor, he experiences a rush of pure joy. Two enemies will never bother him again. Two lousy sons of bitches melted into air and gun smoke. Like a prisoner who has killed his guards, he steps lightly through an open door. Progressive education. When Kim was 15, his father allowed him to withdraw from the school because he was so unhappy there and so much disliked by the other boys and their parents. I don't want that boy in the house again, said Colonel Greenfield. He looks like a sheep-killing dog. It is a walking corpse, said a St. Louis matron poisonously. Years later, Kim settled that account. When informed of her death, he said, it isn't every corpse that can walk, hers can't. The boy is rotten clear through and he stinks like a polecat, Judge Ferris pontificated. But this was more or less true. When angered, aroused, or excited, Kim flushed bright red and steamed off a rank, a ruddish animal smell. The child is not wholesome, said Mr. Kindheart with his usual restraint. Kim was the most unpopular boy in the school, if not in the town of St. Louis. They got nothing to teach anyway, his father said. Well, the headmaster's a fucking priest. The summers they spent at the farm, and Kim loved squirrel hunting in the early morning, and usually went hunting with Jerry Ellisor, who lived next door, because Jerry had a slinky black hound dog. And everybody knows you can't find any squirrels without a dog to bark up the tree where a squirrel is. Kim remembers a friend of his father's, an unobtrusively wealthy man who traveled all over the world studying unusual methods of hand-to-hand fighting. And he wrote a book about it. Kim remembers him as looking very safe and happy. He could kill anyone in sight and he knew it. And that was a good feeling. The book was fascinating. Chinese practitioners who can kill with a soft, twisting blow just in the right place and at the right time. The soft touch, it is called. Kim hummed the funeral march happily. And a magnificent, sulky old Indian who specialized in a lightning blow to the testicles. The golden target, he called it. He was the most unpleasant man I have ever met, the writer reports. After a scant quarter hour in his company, I was impotent for a full week. So the writer, he tries to impress this old Midas by breaking a stack of bricks with his karate chop. And the Indian sets up an equal stack and adds one brick. Then he just sort of lightly thumps the stack. And the writer points a finger at the top brick, which is undamaged. The old practitioner lifts the top brick. All the bricks under it have been shattered as if hit by a sledgehammer. And a bartender in Paris had fashioned a weapon from his breath. By taking certain herbs, he had developed the breath so pestiferous that then standing almost 6 feet away, breathed on me. Words cannot convey the vertiginous, retching horror that enveloped me as I lost consciousness. And for days after, I shuddered at the memory of that awesome breath. Well, he beats the skunk at his own game, but Generally speaking, when it comes down to hand, teeth, claw, poison, quill, shark, fighting, animals beat humans in any direction. So Kim had, of course, thought of living weapons, but the only animal has been taught to attack reliably on command is the dog, though many other animals will be vastly more efficient as fighting machines. The bobcat, the lynx, the incomparable wolverine that can drive a bear from its kill. Kim looked in disdain at Jerry's dog, Rover, a skulking, cowardly, inefficient animal. Kim usually spotted the squirrel before Rover could sniff it out. When Jerry wasn't around, Kim would corner Rover and transfix him with his witch stare as he intoned, "Bad dog." And Rover begins to cower and cringe and whimper, and finally, desperate to ingratiate himself, he rolls on his back and pisses all over himself. While Kim enjoyed this spectacle, it was not enough to compensate for the continuous proximity of this filthy, fawning, vicious, shit-eating beast. Well, but then, who am I to be critical, Kim thought philosophically. Kim had just read a juicy story about African medicine men who capture hyenas and blind them with red-hot needles and burn out their vocal cords as they intone certain spells, binding the tortured animals to their will to fashion a silent, dedicated instrument of death. Kim looked speculatively at Rover and licks his lips. And Rover creeps whimpering behind Jerry's legs. The colonel fills his pipe. They attacked at dawn like gray shadows. I saw a boy go down hamstrung. Next thing, his throat is ripped out. I couldn't see what was doing. It was like a ghost attack. But the boys knew, and the cry went up, "Shmoon! Shmoon!" That's the native word for hyenas blinded by their beastly medicine men. Now, we intended to capture a male gorilla. The mountain species are somewhat smaller than the lowland breeds. So we had a cage just so big and big enough, and I managed to nip into it and lock the door. I'll never forget my boys pleading to be let in as the hyenas tore them apart. That sight will haunt me to my dying day. Couldn't chance it, you know. One boy wasn't the door, and that would have been it. In their blind animal panic, they couldn't understand my position. They screamed curses at me. Well, Kim put it, what can you expect from people with no breeding? Oh, yes, of course, exactly. Kipling, you know, the writer chap, speaks of the lesser breed without the law. Awfully depressing, all that. Kim recruits a band of flamboyant and picturesque outlaws called the Wild Fruits. There's the crying gun who breaks into tears at sight of his opponent. What the matter, somebody take your lollipop? Oh, senor, I am sorry for you. And the priest who goes into a gunfight, giving his adversary the last rite. And the blind gun who zeroes in with bat squeaks. Kim trains his men to identify themselves with death. He takes some rookie guns out to a dead horse rotting in the sun, eviscerated by vultures. Kim points to the horse steaming there in the noonday heat. All right, roll in it. What? Roll in it. Get the stink of death into your chaps and your boots and your guns and your hair. Well, most of us puked at first, but we got used to it and vultures followed us around, hopefully. We always ride into town with the wind behind us. The townspeople gag and retch. My God, what's that stink? It's the stink of death, citizens. And I think, personally, the whole planet stinks of death. And what are we going to do about it? Well, all this may have happened many times before in this old universe. Here we are, trillions of years ago in Galaxy X, and a rally has been organized to protest the use of black holes as an energy source. A bit late, as it turned out. Closing time, gentlemen. Brian Geisen has a bedtime story. It seems that trillions of years ago, a giant flicked grease from his fingers. One of these gobs of grease is our universe on its way to the floor. This piece is called The Unworthy Vessel. Daddy Longlegs looked like Uncle Sam on stilts, and he ran this osteopath clinic outside East St. Louis and took in a few junkie patients. For two notes a week, they could stay on the nod in green lawn chairs and look at the oaks and grass stretching down to a little lake in the sun. The nurse moves around the lawn with her silver tray, feeding the junk in. We called her mother, wouldn't you? Doc Benway and me was holed up there after a rumble in Dallas involving this aphrodisiac ointment. Doc goofed on ether and mixed in too much Spanish fly and burned the prick off the police commissioner. So we come to Daddy Longlegs to cool off, and we find him cool and casual in a dark room with potted rubber plants and a silver tray on the table where he likes to see a week in advance. The nurse shows us to a room with rose wallpaper, and we have this bell. Any hour of the day or night, just ring, and mother charges in with a loaded hypo. One day, we are sitting out in the lawn chairs with lap robes, and Doc picks up a piece of grass. He says, "Junk turns you on vegetable. It's green, see? A green fix should last a long time." So we check out of the clinic and rent a house, and Doc starts cooking up this green junk. The basement is full of tanks, smell like a compost heap of junkies. So finally he draws off this heavy green fluid and loads it into a hypo big as a bicycle pump. "Now we must find a worthy vessel," he says. "And we flush out this old goofball artist and tell him it is pure Chinese H from the Ling Dynasty. And Doc shoots the whole pint of green right into the main line. Yellow jacket turns fibers gray green and withers up like an old turnip. And I say, "I'm getting out of here, me." Doc says, "An unworthy vessel, obviously. Withdraw from the case." Thank you.